America's light unto the world.
Looks a lot like sparks from a controversial debate over Islam.
Plan to build a mosque right near Ground Zero.
It's like building a shrine to the very philosophy that motivated the 9/11 attackers. So
and there has been great outrage following plans for a mosque.
That debate surrounding the mosque was heated even before the president weighed in.
We used to ask right after 9/11, why do they hate us?
Now voices around the world ask, what's going on in America?
Of burning books and building mosques. It's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee from Public Radio International and WNYC.
Good morning, everyone. It's Thursday, September 9th, a debate in America and the world watches.
Yeah, that's right at the top of the news this morning is the President Obama and the Florida church's plan to burn copies of the Quran this weekend. Speaking on ABC News this morning, the president says the event will only inflame the enemy.
This is a recruitment bonanza for Al-Qaeda. You could have serious violence in places like Pakistan. Or Afghanistan.
The plan has drawn widespread domestic and international condemnation. Military officials, including General David Petraeus, say the event is likely to trigger violent retaliation against American troops abroad. The pastor says his church is campaigning against what he calls radical Islam. He has no intention of backing down.
Firefighters are struggling to contain a massive wildfire continuing to burn in Colorado north of Boulder. The weather is again expected to improve later today, but Laura McConnell of the fire management team says people need to remain vigilant.
We do have an increase of humidity to expect. However, the potential for fire spread is still pretty high.
And four people are still missing. The blaze has so far burned 6,200 acres. It's destroyed 136 homes, making it the most destructive fire in the state's history. Some evacuation orders are expected to be lifted today, though, while thousands of others will wait to learn if their homes are still intact.
A federal appeals court in San Francisco has thrown out a suit brought by five foreign men who say they were kidnapped and tortured by the CIA. The court ruled former prisoners of the intelligence agency cannot sue over alleged torture in overseas prisons. Citing potential exposure of government secrets, the Ninth Circuit Court says as a result, such cases cannot be allowed to go forward. The American Civil Liberties Union, who brought the suit on behalf of the men, says it will appeal to the Supreme Court. And economists have revised projected economic growth downward for the rest of the year. That forecast comes as President Obama reminded voters of his opinion that Democrats are the best to handle the economy. In Ohio, the president said his policies are the only ones trying to get America out of the slump. He rolled out a new $100 billion tax credit plan, saying it'll give businesses the boost they need.
This will help small businesses upgrade their plants and equipment, and will encourage large corporations to get off the sidelines and start putting their profits to work.
The president holds a new news conference tomorrow at the White House where the economy is expected to be one of the top issues.
Prosecutors in Mexico say they have arrested seven men in connection with the drug cartel suspected massacre of 72 people last month. The arrests come as another Mexican mayor was murdered execution style in his office. Mexican intelligence says the Zeta cartel has been moving into the area. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton reacted, saying the country is beginning to resemble war-torn Colombia. The cartels are to blame, she said.
We face an increasing threat from a well-organized network drug trafficking threat that is in some cases morphing into or making common cause with what we would consider an insurgency.
One government spokesman reacting to the word insurgency called Clinton's comments misleading and rude. Space Shuttle Discovery is beginning its last trip to the vehicle assembly building at the Kennedy Space Center this morning. Discovery will get its fuel tank and booster rockets ahead of its last trip into space this fall. Asian markets mixed. European indices up. Futures are up. The Dow starts at 10,387. The S&P starts at 1,098. And the Nasdaq starts trading at 22.28. Later on in the program, war through literature as an understanding, a path to understanding.
And then a conversation about the state of the United States and the conversation about Muslims in America. We'll talk about that in a moment.
Good morning, everyone. We're going to take a trip around what I think sounds to me like a very new world in the next few minutes.
You can think of it as an oral tour of the globe. Listen, because you may not recognize the people behind the voices you're about to hear, but you'll certainly recognize the ideas.
A controversial plan to build a mosque right near Ground Zero.
I need to remind the audience that This story first broke last December in the New York Times, and no one objected.
However, some of the families of 9/11 victims say they are offended by the whole idea.
This controversy only began in May.
It's like building a shrine to the very philosophy that motivated the 9/11 attackers.
Some politicians who decided to use this for certain political purposes.
The world is not only for Americans. The world is not only for British. The world is, you know, we have plenty of differences.
Familiar ideas from news footage, of course, we all heard from the spring and summer about the controversial plans to build a mosque in Lower Manhattan. The voice of the imam from that mosque, Faisal Abdul Rauf, was speaking last night on CNN. You heard him there.
And the last voice you heard was from Jakarta, Indonesia. It was a Muslim named Damien, one of many voices actually weighing in on the American controversy that's now the focus of the entire world.
America debates, the world listens. If U.S. political leaders thought they were putting an issue to rest this summer in their statements about the plans to build that Islamic center in Lower Manhattan, well, they were sadly mistaken. Remember Mayor Michael Bloomberg here in New York saying this a few weeks back?
The simple fact is, this building is private property, and the owners have a right to use the building as a house of worship. And the government has no right whatsoever to deny that right. And if it were tried, the courts would almost certainly strike it down as a violation of the U.S. Constitution.
A definitive statement for sure, but it did not settle the debate. President Obama commented on the mosque plans, you may remember that, and then he ended up having to explain himself.
I was commenting very specifically on the right that people have that dates back to our founding. That's what our country is about. I think it's very important that we stay focused on who we are as a people and what our values are all about.
Who are Americans as a people and what are American values all about? It's not just a focus for Americans.
No, this is the focus of the world, and this is something that the United States has for many years said that we're a model of American democracy and tolerance.
How good of a model? Well, that premise was tested by our partners, the BBC. The program World Have Your Say convened here in the United States a town meeting of the entire world on the question of an Islamic center in Lower Manhattan and other issues of Islam in America. Here's a sampling.
Perhaps what this opportunity is an opportunity for America to directly confront its own issues with accepting Islam as part of its community and part of its society in the fullness that it should be.
This is Sandra. I'm from Ottawa, Canada. How do you educate and attenuate that feeling of absolute outrage where they believe that those that attack them are now going to be two blocks away from the greatest damage that they've had?
I'm Chris Rampersad from Trinidad and Tobago, and I think we have evolved as a society because we are a small island, and over the last 500 years, we've had people come in there from many parts of the world with their different religions. We didn't have a choice but to learn to live with each other.
Hi, I'm Emily Sikazwe. I come from Zambia. I'm a Christian, and I believe that we all have to live in a world where we tolerate each other and respect each other's religions. I think the argument that some Americans are giving about the mosque on Ground Zero, I think it is so, so unfortunate.
My name is Isaac, and I'm from Kenya. There's something that I really find disturbing when we start talking about this mosque, and it's using the word tolerance. I don't really believe that is the word that we should be using.
What's wrong with the word, Isaac?
Because when you say tolerance, this is like trying to accommodate something that you don't really like and that you can't live with, but you just don't have a choice. But it's not about having a choice. It's just about having mutual respect.
I'm going to get a show of hands here. Just one quick. Who thinks there's a problem with the word tolerance?
A show of hands. Who thinks there's a problem with the word tolerance? It has so many different meanings on so many different levels.
And it elicits so many different reactions.
That's Nuala McGovern hosting World Have Your Say for our partner, the BBC, on this question of Islam in America and how the debate in the United States resonates around the world, some of those voices from around the world. And it's not just the Islamic Cultural Center in Lower Manhattan that's sparking debate.
If only it were.
Yeah, indeed. Listen to this.
We are burning a book. We are not killing someone. We are not murdering people. We are not dragging people out of the cars who are doctors and killing them. We are simply burning a book. The general needs to point his finger to radical Islam and tell them to shut up.
That's Terry Jones, pastor in Gainesville, Florida, whose plans to burn Qurans this weekend as part of his own personal and his church's commemoration of 9/11 has angered General David Petraeus in Afghanistan, who says that demonstration in Gainesville, Florida could threaten U.S. troops in Afghanistan.
And there's evidence that the general is right. Tuesday, protesters in Afghanistan reportedly burned an effigy of Pastor Terry Jones.
Well, taking action in Gainesville are other religious leaders. Listen.
I have proclaimed September 11th, 2010, as Interfaith Solidarity Day in the city of Gainesville. And that is what we want to project to the world. That is who our community is, and not this tiny fringe group that has attracted this unfortunate attention to our city.
Muslims in Florida, including in Gainesville and South Florida, as well as Muslims around the entire United States, have taken the position that we will not respond to this burning in any forcible, violent manner. We are not doing any counter-protests. We are, in fact, doing exactly the opposite.
But what will be the response to the Quran burning if it takes place on Saturday? This is what Damien wanted to talk about when he called into the BBC's World Have Your Say.
The world is not only for Americans. The world is not only for British. The world is, you know, we have plenty of differences, and we will have to appreciate people coming from different backgrounds, you know. Probably for Christians, it is easier. It is much easier to handle this kind of thing. But in Islam, there is some laws relating to this. That when you are attacked, then you are allowed to attack back, to retaliate. And this is what concerns us most, you know, the retaliation.
What will be the world reaction to what happens in the United States? Which brings us back to the words of Faisal Abdul-Rauf, talking about his concerns about radicals all over the world to what happens in the United States.
I am extremely concerned about sensitivity, but I also have a responsibility. If we moved from that location, the story will be that the radicals have taken over the discourse. The headlines in the Muslim world will be that Islam is under attack. And I'm less concerned about the radicals in America than I'm concerned about the radicals in the Muslim world.
Voices around the world responding to voices in the United States, echoes of radicalism, not just in the U.S., but around the globe.
And at 15 minutes after the hour, let's check in on some headlines.
A federal appeals court has ruled that former CIA prisoners cannot sue over alleged torture overseas because such a lawsuit risks exposing government secrets. The extraordinary rendition ruling was a big defeat for the American Civil Liberties Union. The ACLU plans to appeal to the Supreme Court. In Pakistan, a missile killed five alleged militants early this morning. It was the fourth such attack in 24 hours. That brings the one-day death toll to as many as 20 people. President Barack Obama told ABC's Good Morning America that his chief of staff, Rahm Emanuel, would make a great mayor of Chicago, but that Emanuel should wait to pursue his dream till after the midterm elections.
That's interesting.
I know. Emanuel has long expressed interest in running for Chicago mayor one day. That job actually opened up earlier this week when Mayor Richard M. Daley announced he will not seek a seventh term.
BP's contractors are responding to the company's internal report on the Deepwater Horizon accident that spilled millions of barrels of oil into the Gulf of Mexico. Drilling firm Transocean says BP's findings are self-serving, and cement contractor blamed in part by BP for the accident. Halliburton says the report contains omissions and inaccuracies. In North Texas, two people have drowned in flooding from the remnants of Tropical Storm Hermine. The storm's relatively light landfall Monday, resulted in people unprepared for tornadoes and floodwaters, which also accompanied the landfall. That's a look at some of the stories we're watching this morning. We want to keep the conversation going on the Islamic Center and mosque near Ground Zero, the debate over what's going to happen on September 11th this year. We heard from listeners to the BBC show, World Have Your Say, but it's time to have your chance to have your say. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. What is the place of Islam in America? If it's not near Ground Zero, then where? Our number again, 877-8-MY-TAKE. So excited about this segment.
Really?
I am so excited.
Well, we just talked about some very deep and serious religious divides in the country, right? So you can address that in a number of ways. You can write some op-eds.
Yep.
You can hold conferences, interfaith.
All important.
Very, very important.
Sure.
Or you can play on a sticky wicket.
There you go.
Detective Jeff Thompson is with us. And I want you to tell this a story. You were working on outreach for the NYPD, the New York Police Department.
Right.
And you were walking around the neighborhoods and you started to notice something. What was it?
Well, myself and Sergeant Rana, when we walk through certain neighborhoods and areas, All they do is watch cricket. All they do is play cricket. Everywhere you look is cricket, whether it's in person or on TV, in the restaurants, in the places.
And this was at a time when the NYPD, after 9/11, was really concerned about bringing people together and making sure they understood what Muslim communities were doing in the United States.
Well, right, yeah. The cricket program that we're talking about, that's just one example of all different ways of different communities that we reach out to, and cricket, in this particular case, was determined to be the best way to create those relationships.
So Police Commissioner Ray Kelly got an idea.
I'm learning about the runs, the wickets, outs. I find it exciting. I actually hit the ball on several occasions.
It's the
commish.
That is the commish trying to play cricket. They have about 200 young kids, most of them Muslim. They're the Pac Brighton, the Punjab, the Cosmos, the Panthers. These are teenagers from the outer boroughs. They're playing cricket for the NYPD United. And with us today, we've got Detective Jeff Thompson and Sergeant Adil Rana of the NYPD Community Affairs Bureau. The league is now in its third season. And as I understand, Sergeant Adil, the participation has actually doubled in the 3 years since it started.
It has. And especially this year, we had new participants that we never had the past 2 years. So the word is going around. And we're getting individuals from all over the world, like Bangladesh, Pakistan, Jamaica, Guyana, India, and all over, and they all participate and, you know, play with each other and have a great time on the field.
Now, did you play cricket as a young kid?
Yes, I did.
Did you play, Jeff Thompson?
No, I've only been playing for about 6 years. But I'm not that bad. And just say the commissioner, when he did play, he's pretty good, too.
So the Police Athletic League in New York is famous for using athletics to improve relations for youth in troubled neighborhoods around the city. But what's unique about this program? It's addressing not only just sort of general youth issues, but what else?
Well, this program, it reaches out to the new immigrants that coming into this country. They're not used to any involvement with the police, because when you're coming from a different country, you know, the police are looked at it differently. You know, when you come here, and through the cricket and the outreach that we did, people are much comfortable with us. People had that fear until they actually met us. We did the outreach. We played with them. We played with the kids. And they were actually surprised to see that the police department is much more than just enforcement. We actually had to help them out and build that relationship with each other.
Okay, so they're surprised that the police are involved in cricket. What are you guys surprised at? I mean, you've been doing this for how many years?
We just completed the third season.
And you must have gotten some surprises along the way.
Well, one of the things that we got to experience, not just myself and Sergeant Rana, it took a lot of people to put this together, starting from the commission all the way down.
Sure.
But they're young men, the young Muslim men, but they're just like everyone else. So when we're out there playing, we play with them, and other cops play with them as well. Everyone's the same. They want to play cricket. They want to win. And one of the other things that we did last year, and we did again this year, is we looked at what else do they do besides just play cricket. Otherwise, you know, they want to play cricket at every moment. But they also go on the internet. So we created a website, a YouTube page, a Twitter account that has over 400 people following us, which is even more than the amount of participants, which at first I admit I wasn't really sure what Twitter was 3 years ago. When I said, they're using it, we should use it.
Well, you say that there's officers, and they had to have been officers who had to learn all the very, you know, complicated rules of cricket. They had to learn about bowling karum balls and knocking dill scoops. And
no, absolutely right. I mean, they
can you explain the dill scoop?
No.
We don't have time for that.
He refuses to do that.
We don't have time
another
on this program
day.
Well, talk about police work for a second. Ray Kelly has mentioned on many, many occasions that it's key for him to get at the radicalization point of Muslim youth in the United States as a way of combating terrorism and also opening channels into communities that the police didn't necessarily have eyes on in the past. Without characterizing you as spies, do you think this program helps you with that?
Well, I would absolutely go back to what you just said. Definitely, we're not spies. We're here to help them out. We're here to do the outreach. We're here to build that gap that, you know, is lost during the enforcement time, during right after, you know, September 11, where people were afraid to come out and actually speak to the police officers, because, you know, some people, you have to admit, the legal status is not, you know, they don't have the legal status. But with us doing this outreach, we're able to explain to them about the mayor's executive order 41, where, you know, they don't have to be afraid.
People are responding to that.
Yes, absolutely. Mm-hmm. People are absolutely responding to that. They didn't know anything about this executive order. They actually thought that whenever we talk to somebody, we actually run their immigrations. So, you know, this is by...
Go ahead.
Yeah, one thing that I always like to point out, too, is the idea behind the cricket program came directly from the police commissioner. And it wasn't, let's just put cricket together and then whoever shows up and plays. No, it was more an idea behind to reach out primarily towards young men in the Muslim community. And what's the most genuine way to do that? It was through the sport of cricket. So cricket was that bridge to bring us together. And just like personal examples of my involvement as well as the sergeants, a lot of the times when we're out there, other than them laughing at me saying that I was trying to play cricket, being able to talk and engage them in conversations, not just about cricket, and a lot of times it's whether Australia is better than Pakistan, but
who's
even
better, Australia or Pakistan?
Well, he's married to an Australian.
Now there's going to be a lot of more arguments. But then another good thing that we learned was looking at it, a lot of these young men, they've never had any interaction before whatsoever with the NYPD, and what better way than create it through cricket, the sport of cricket? And I think that was a genuine way to create that relationship.
Detective Jeff Thompson and Sergeant Adil Rana, both of the NYPD and the Cricket League through the NYPD. Their standings are reported through the local Pakistani language newspapers. Thanks, guys.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
Character and is British. Now God laid down the rules of life when he wrote those Ten Commandments.
So you hear the political speeches. How do you do the numbers? So we're going to give you a sense of the real cost of the Bush-era tax cuts. Louise Story explains it all to you in just a moment. Right now, let's check in on top news stories at 30 minutes after the hour. President Obama is weighing in on a Florida church's plans to burn copies of the Quran this weekend. The president calls the event a, quote, recruiting bonanza for al-Qaeda. The pastor of the church says he's not planning to cancel. South Africa's police minister says the country's murder rate has dropped by nearly 9%. Murders in the country have dipped below 17,000 for the first time in nearly three decades. However, the country still has one of the highest murder rates in the world.
We're waiting now for weekly unemployment claim numbers from the Labor Department that's expected out this hour. The government is expected to report that people requesting unemployment benefits for the first time will drop by 2,000 to 470,000. Let's check in on the markets. Asian markets are mixed. European indices are up, and so are futures. The Dow's going to start at 10,387, the S&P at 1,098, and the NASDAQ will open up at 2,228. Those are some of the news stories that we're following this morning.
President Obama was on message yesterday, speaking at Cuyahoga Community College in Parma, Ohio.
Do we return to the same failed policies that ran our economy into a ditch, or do we keep moving forward with policies that are slowly pulling us out?
Criticizing the Republicans there, but also offering a program of his own. Here's Obama offering tax cuts for businesses, and he gave us a sense of what the Bush tax cuts and maintaining them actually is going to cost.
This isn't to punish folks who are better off. God bless them. It's because we can't afford the $700 billion price tag.
$700 billion price tag. The president announces a program of tax cuts for businessmen and also says that the Bush tax cuts can't be maintained because they cost too much. It's a political message, but it also gets the brain cells of people like Louise Story, our takeaway finance contributor and Wall Street and finance reporter for our partner, the New York Times, a thinking about what actually these numbers mean and how you could calculate reality from within the political message. Louise, good morning.
Good morning.
So when you hear messages like this, we can't, you know, stay with failed policies, and there's a $700 billion price tag to maintaining certain tax cuts. How do you try to fact check these numbers?
Well, I try to think, you know, in the bigger macro scale of what these numbers compare to. So first of all, one thing we've got to keep in mind is that what people are debating are the tax cuts, the Bush tax cuts for the wealthiest people, the people who make as a couple more than $250,000. That's 2% of taxpayers.
Right.
So this is
small
a very
number.
Small, elite part of the population. And as the president said, that those cuts would cost us another $700 billion over the next 10 years. What people are not talking about as much, but, you know, should be considered is the Bush tax cuts affected all of us. And actually extending them for all of us, because, you know, even the bottom rate went down from 15% to 10%. These weren't just tax cuts for the wealthy. The price tag for all of that is close to $3
trillion. $3
trillion. That's right, in the next 10 years. And $3 trillion is, you know, a lot of dollars. When you think about, you know, our budget deficit. Our national debt now is over $13 trillion, and you think about the interest costs we're going to have paying for it, it's $3 trillion is a lot of dollars. So the other thing to think about is how do these numbers compare? So we're talking about top 2% of the population would cost us $700 billion. The rest of the 98% of the population, you know, cost us the rest of it. So what we're saying is that we want to, if you give them to the wealthy, they get 25% of the benefit, 25% of that $2.7 trillion cost goes to pay these top 2% in tax cuts. It really seems a little lopsided, at least at first.
How do you handle the argument which says that, all right, if you get rid of these tax, if you get rid of taxes, people will spend the money and that it constitutes a certain kind of stimulus? How do you calculate what the stimulus effect of maintaining the tax cuts might be?
So this is, you know, you're referring to the trickle-down economics. So actually, the Congressional Budget Office has done studies of this, and they came out and they said, yes, in fact, if you keep these tax cuts, there will be some benefits. Like, for instance, it'll lower unemployment by 0.8% more than it would have. But then let's do the numbers on that. Well, what is that? You know, we're at 9.6% unemployment.
Right.
Well, that's, you know, just over a million jobs. It's not getting us down to, you know, 5% unemployment. You know, but when you think of spending, the thing to think about is that the wealthy spend a lower percentage of their income than you and I do.
Right.
Because
right.
they have so much of it. I mean, there's only so much you can spend.
So it's more in raw dollars, but it's a much smaller percentage.
Yes. In raw dollars, the wealthy spend like a third of all of consumer spending. It's a lot in raw dollars, but it's a smaller percentage of their cut.
So that's a way of thinking about the cost of the tax cuts, because
that's
you're
right.
not getting a full pass-through.
Right.
They reduce the spending of these various income brackets, particularly at the top. It doesn't all go flowing back
Absolutely
into the
not.
Economy.
I mean, as we just said, they get 25% of the benefit, but then they only go and they don't spend all of it. The Congressional Budget Office also calculated this, and they come out with, at most, you get 40 cents on the dollar of economic growth from tax cuts. And there's other policies you could do that they say would have a bigger impact on the economy.
So the takeaway here is this is an expensive way to do economic growth.
You know, it's hard to find any way that you get a dollar for dollar
right.
benefit, but this is not a dollar for dollar benefit, and there's a lot of other options. You know, one thing I was thinking yesterday, I don't know what you think, is if the goal is to stimulate the economy, why not tax money that people spend? But if they don't spend it, because the justification here is we want to keep taxes, the cuts in, so people will spend money. So let's say, okay, then if you spend it, you don't get taxed. But if you save it, then you do.
So that's an incentive for spending.
Right. That's
so,
right.
So it's a disincentive for savings, which we've also talked about on this program. You kind of want people to save, but maybe the people at the high end of the bracket, you don't want to save quite
right.
so much.
Right. And if the policy goal of keeping the tax cuts is to get people to spend money to rally the economy, then maybe fine-tune the policy a little more when you do the math and look at the numbers.
But politically, how would that go down? Basically, a tax credit for rich people
down.
Buying a Lexus. Basically, it's you can take a tax credit for buying a Lexus because it stimulates the economy, or buying a GM car or something.
I can see the coverage now.
But isn't that how this is already going? You know, all of the people out there arguing to keep these tax cuts for the wealthy are arguing essentially that you need them so that they will spend money because they're a third of consumer spending. So all I'm saying is if that's why you're doing it, perhaps you should make sure they really do spend the money that they're getting the cut on.
Based on the numbers that you've looked at, and maybe I'm pushing Louise's story out on a limb here.
You are.
I might be. I tend to do things like that. Would you describe the Bush tax cuts as a failed policy of the past, as the president did yesterday?
There have been some studies of this, and when you look at GDP growth, actually, it hadn't, and the deficit wasn't growing in proportion to GDP until the recession, really, is what most economists have found. So
until the recession, it might have been a decent idea.
Right.
After the recession, bad idea.
Well, what's unclear, though, is maybe the recession would have been worse if we didn't have them. But as we've just said here today, it's not a dollar-for-dollar benefit. In fact, economists have found a higher benefit for using the money instead of tax cuts, just as unemployment benefits, because putting that money in people's pockets who aren't employed means they can go spend. So there are some policies that have a higher return.
Finally, Dan Gross on this program from Newsweek, who sometimes does the agenda segment with us on Mondays, said that the fastest stimulus, economists agree, is a tax holiday, a tax moratorium, where you basically say payroll taxes, we're stopping them for a month. If you did the numbers on that, could you get closer to the dollar-for-dollar pass-through, do you think?
Yes. The CBO did a big study in January, and they found the top two immediate big buck impacts are to either give a lot more money out in unemployment benefits to people or to halt or lower payroll taxes and businesses, like you just said. So those are the quickest, the biggest, but, you know, everything has downsides.
All right. Louise Story, Wall Street and finance reporter for The New York Times, doing the numbers on the president staying on message on the economy. A news conference is going to be held tomorrow at the White House. We'll have more details on that. Louise, thanks so much.
The U.S. military has called the killing of two American soldiers by an Iraqi soldier this week a, quote, deliberate act. The two U.S. soldiers were killed. Nine were wounded in an attack at a military base north of Baghdad. These are the first casualties for the military since President Obama declared an end to U.S. combat operations in Iraq on August 31st. Stephen Lee Myers joins us now. He's the Baghdad bureau chief for our partner, The New York Times. And Stephen, it seems like there's more that we don't know about this incident than that we do.
That's right. They say they have launched an investigation, both the Iraqis and the Americans, trying to find out what happened. Some of the relatives of the Iraqi soldier involved said that he might have been teased, but the Americans are saying that's not the case. They're describing this as a deliberate attack on the American forces there.
They have detained his brother to try and investigate what may have been going on, but from the reports that we've gotten out of there that you cite in your writing, he seemed to have been in a good mood and had a good attitude all morning long, was going about his duties.
That's what people who knew him said, and so there's a bit of a mystery as what prompted him to open fire when the Americans were on the base with him that day, whether or not there was some sort of ideological motive or some other reason why he would have opened fire, but they're saying he did so deliberately.
Well, and there's a couple concerns here. One, that they are trying to, that there's an effort to bring U.S. non-combat troops into conflict. And another could be that people are worried that this is a reaction to some of the religious divide going on in the United States in the conversation about the mosque in New York and the Quran burning in Florida.
It's impossible to say at this point that there's a connection with that, though that has resonated here in Iraq as it has in other parts of the Arab world. I think in this case, what the incident shows is that the American forces, despite the declared end of combat last week by President Obama, continue to work with Iraqi security forces. On Sunday, they were at a military compound that came under attack by al-Qaeda insurgents, and they were involved in defending the building, firing their weapons. No Americans were hurt in that case. But in this one, you have an American unit that's embedded, working closely with an Iraqi unit, and something prompted this attack. It shows that even though the combat mission has been declared finished, there still remains an enormous amount of danger for any American soldier working here.
Has the military said that this will change any of their actions or their policies there for the non-combat troops?
No, they emphasized yesterday quite clearly that they don't expect it to have any change in the relationship, and they're going to continue to work closely with the Iraqis.
Stephen Lee Myers is the Baghdad bureau chief for our partner, The New York Times. He's talking about the killing of two American soldiers this week by an Iraqi soldier. We still have no idea what the motive was behind that attack, and I'm sure that the investigations will uncover more. This is a particular moment in Iraq. It is a particular moment in the United States, and it's something we're talking about all morning long. Hillary Clinton, before the Council on Foreign Relations, called this a new American moment. We're asking you, what kind of moment are we in? And what are the defining moments in American history? Let us know at 877-8-MY-TAKE, or you can post your comment to thetakeaway.org. Good morning. Celeste Headley here with John Hockenberry. Let's get a look at the headlines at 47 minutes after the hour. This week's unemployment numbers are out. Initial jobless claims fell 27,000 from last week's revised figure. That's a two-month low. Economists had predicted a much smaller decline of just 2,000.
And that's, futures are on fire. So
they're going up yeah. significantly Positive. Every second. This amid news from the Labor Department. The job openings are rising modestly. President Obama is weighing in both on the Quran burning controversy and the economy. Speaking in Cleveland, the president unveiled a $180 billion stimulus package. He said voters face a stark choice this fall.
Do we return to the same failed policies that ran our economy into a ditch, or do we keep moving forward with policies
that are slowly pulling us out.
This morning, he urged the pastor in Florida who's planning to burn Qurans on 9/11 to think again.
Yeah, he told ABC News it would be a bonanza, a recruiting bonanza for Al-Qaeda.
Yeah,
those were his words. The U.S. Navy says it's reclaimed control of a pirate-held vessel off the coast of Somalia and taken 9 prisoners. The American raid took place just before dawn today. Pirates had boarded the German-owned Magellan Star yesterday. New documents released by the Army say a staff sergeant charged with murdering Afghan civilians also kept body parts of his victims and threatened subordinates. Documents charging Staff Sergeant Calvin Gibbs and 4 other soldiers say Gibbs kept finger bones, leg bones, and a tooth taken from Afghan corpses. Those are some of the news stories we're watching this morning.
War is sometimes described as a tragic but inescapable fate for humankind. No generation has been isolated from warfare. It can actually elicit a surge of national pride. Think about the invasion of Normandy or the liberation of Auschwitz. Or it can shake the nation to its core. Feelings of horror and confusion, perhaps the bombing of Hiroshima or the My Lai massacre. Patrick Henry Bass joins us now. He says literature can actually help us grapple with these confusing emotions that are involved in war. He's a senior editor at Essence Magazine, and he's brought some recommendations with him that he says could help us put the Iraq and Afghanistan wars into context. But I have to ask you, Patrick, is it really better to read a book than it is to, say, watch some news reports or get the actual documents, the footage from the war?
I'd say both, really. Give peace a chance. Give reading a chance, absolutely. The projects that I've chosen are interesting because when we think of novels about war, we think of A Farewell to Arms, we think of War and Peace. Some people even think of Atonement, All Quiet on the Western Front. Many people find
that's
it as the
favorite
most definitive book of the 20th century, correct, in terms of war. But I wanted to look at projects where there were no heroes in terms of war. And what's happened with war in the United States, at least in the last 25 years, there's been a religious fervor attached to war. So one of the first projects that I looked at was, and I hope everyone will check out, is The War Prayer by Mark Twain. And Mark Twain is really having a resurgence.
Amazing.
These days, he was a Newsweek cover guy, and Mont Blanc has named a pen for him in a special limited edition. But
I'm sure he's thrilled with that. Yeah.
People are moving further and further away from the Mark Twain who was Samuel Clemens. Who had a darker view of the world and humanity in The War Prayer, which he wrote in response to the Spanish-American War and then the Philippine War. It's a powerful look at religious fervor in one way, but also just he's cynical about war. He's also saying that when we pray that we will win in a war, does God not listen to our enemies as well? That poem, War Prayer, essentially, because it was a parable, was rejected by his publisher, and it was published only after his death in 1925. And now that everyone is looking forward
and
to his...
It really sort of echoes or anticipates what Hemingway was writing about the Spanish-American War just a few years later after that was published posthumously.
Exactly. And every time there is a war, this prayer gains more and more momentum. So I discovered the prayer because people were sending it around right at the height of the Iraq
unfortunately
war.
It gets excerpted a lot, and I would say you really can't appreciate
that. You have to read the text in its totality. It's about 96 pages in its totality, which is available on Amazon.com and BarnesandNoble.com. I'm also moved by Joan Didion's Democracy, which looked at the Vietnam War. It was told against the backdrop of the Vietnam War. And you're talking about CIA operatives. You're talking about a murder in Hawaii. And the war itself is sort of the backdrop. But if you really want to get an understanding of the confusion, the anxiety, the mixed metaphors, just the sense of isolation that Americans were feeling during the Vietnam War, I don't think you could find a better novel than Democracy.
And Democracy was written after Didion's really extraordinary reporting about the situation in El Salvador during the Reagan years. So in many ways, she uses Vietnam to understand what we were doing in places like El Salvador.
Exactly. And she starts it out in Hawaii, and you know, with the still reeling feeling of Pearl Harbor. And so it's really about the echo of war, you know, the remnants of war, not participating in the war, but
what happens after.
And what war does to the psyche, what war does to identity, what war does to the collective consciousness of a country and a community.
Well, certainly the consciousness of soldiers is the mission of Sebastian Junger's book, War, which is out this year, all about trying to give you a sense of what it's like right now in Afghanistan.
Right.
And Joan Didion's Democracy was heavily criticized when it was first released. Mary McCarthy, who the great Mary McCarthy, who was quite a pacifist, had challenges with the narrative structure of it because it didn't have a hero. And in fact, Joan Didion wrote herself into the text. She was a character in her own novel. And you have the last time someone saw something like that, Dorothy Parker did it in one of her short stories, in which she was making fun of herself.
Well, I mean, one of the books that helped me to first really grapple with war was A Rumor of War by Philip Caputo. And that also, the Vietnam War brought us a lot of books that had no heroes or troubled characters.
Heart of Darkness, the Joseph Conrad story, very much you could tell that Joan Didion drew a lot on Conrad for Democracy. And Democracy is written very cinematically, so you were asking about reportage on television. It really, we owe a lot to radio, Edward R. Murrow and his reports, you know, just to see the war, to bring it alive, you know, from when he was doing those reports. But Didion does that superbly in terms of her imagery.
Well, and Heart of Darkness is also the source material for Apocalypse Now, the Vietnam sort of, I guess you could call it a piece of literature. It's a raggedy, fabulous film.
Right. But John, no one has seemed to really get their hands around the Vietnam War, whether it's in films like Platoon. We still don't have an understanding. I think some people would look at a film like Coming Home with John Voight and Jane Fonda for just what the emotional impact of the Vietnam War was, or The Deer Hunter, you know, and in so many ways. Michael
and there
Cimino's
have been a lot
film.
Of later films that have actually told the war from a more pro-veteran perspective as well. All of them are slices of an experience that's too complex maybe for any one particular film or book.
And I think that's why Democracy succeeds. Looking at that novel 20 or so more years after it was published, I mean, you really can get a sense of just the halcyon craziness that America was at that time.
You know, there are other wars and conflicts that we haven't really come to terms with that did not involve the United States, and there's been a number of books written about the genocide in Rwanda.
Yes.
I can think of Machete Season or We Wish to Inform You That Tomorrow We Will Be Killed with Our Family.
Yes.
Some amazing books written about Rwanda. You brought us another suggestion.
Yes, Say You're One of Them by Oum Akpan, which was greatly reviewed a year and a half ago. It deservedly so, and I think that it still deserves a chance among readers. This is probably one of the most powerful story collections that you'll read, you know, in recent memory. The focus here are children.
Right.
All the stories are children. And
in African conflict zones.
And it's not polemical. So when a child reaches for a piece of candy and he's missing a hand, there's no need to go into exposition about that. When children have been raped, you know, when children are being trained to be boy soldiers, he's really giving you an illumination of their day-to-day lives. So,
and those are realities in places like Uganda, the Lord's Army, Sierra Leone. Yeah.
That's exactly how he captures it. He captures a day in the life of children
who are
in war and who've been affected and impacted by war. Orphans, you know, all of those stories are in Say You're One of Them.
You can actually find a list of the books that Patrick mentioned today at our website, thetakeaway.org. While you're there, add to the list. Help us tell us what books have helped you to better understand the concepts of war and peace. Go to thetakeaway.org. Patrick Henry Bass, Senior Editor for Essence Magazine. Thanks.
Yeah, check out Catch 22.
And we're getting suggestions from listeners. Kat in Cambridge, Massachusetts, tweeted us possibly the best Vietnam War fiction, Tim O'Brien's The Things They Carried, which is terrific. Great choice. Keep your suggestions coming. He also wrote Going After Cacatiato, which is another fabulous book about Vietnam by Tim O'Brien. Check out the Takeaway blog for a glimpse at what we're working on. Add your two cents to war literature or anything else we're talking about. You can find posts from us and contributors and Takeaway guests. We're also talking about this Saturday event planned in Gainesville, Florida, Burn a Quran Day. Is it about free speech, or is it a question, posing a question of what it means to be an American?
My name is Bruce Ledoux from Fishers, Indiana, and my take is, what would Jesus do? I doubt if he would be burning the Quran.
You can weigh in on this as well. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. I'm John Hockenberry.
And I'm Celeste Edley. This is The Takeaway.
Maybe you could say it was the signing of the Constitution.
The Emancipation Proclamation, that's a good candidate.
You could include Martin Luther King's speech or Marian Anderson singing at the Lincoln Memorial.
Or when Neil Armstrong set foot on the moon.
That's one small step for man,
Many say the U.S. is going through its toughest period since the Great Depression. Two wars, one officially ended, economic collapse, deep political and religious divisions.
And yet Hillary Clinton says we're experiencing a new American moment.
What was America's defining moment? Did we miss it? And what will history call this one?
It's the takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee from Public Radio International and WNYC.
Good morning. It is Thursday, September 9th, and this discussion about all the things, there's such a multitude of things going on that all have a resonance in terms of what America values and our basic principles.
Of new American moments and old, famous American moments, yeah. And you're weighing in on them. But let's get a check of the morning's top news stories. We begin with the economy. New claims for unemployment plunged last week by 27,000 to 451,000. Economists had predicted a much smaller decline of just 2,000. The number of people now signing up for unemployment is at a two-month low. A signal companies are slowing the pace of layoffs. Positive news for the president, who's taking his economic message around the country. He lashed out at Republicans yesterday in Ohio, in the same city where Minority Leader John Boehner said the president should fire his economic team. The president told a crowd yesterday his new $100 billion tax credit plan will give businesses the boost they need.
This will help small businesses upgrade their plants and equipment, and will encourage large corporations to get off the sidelines and start putting their profits to work.
The president will emphasize the positive in the economy when he holds a news conference tomorrow.
The president is also adding his voice into the debate over a Florida church's plan to burn copies of the Quran this weekend. Speaking on ABC News this morning, the president says this event will only inflame the enemy.
This is a recruitment bonanza for Al-Qaeda. You could have serious violence in places like Pakistan or Afghanistan.
The plan has drawn widespread domestic and international condemnation. Military officials, including General David Petraeus, say the event is likely to trigger violent retaliation against American troops abroad.
Now to the situation in Colorado, where the wildfire continues to rage this morning. The blaze has charred 7,100 acres, destroyed 136 homes. Firefighters say just 10% of the fire is under control. Laura McConnell of the fire management team there in Colorado says they're throwing all available resources at the fire.
We have 24 engines and approximately 200 firefighters that will be working the incident. We have five operational heavy air tankers that will be working. We have one of the smaller, we commonly refer to it as a SEAT, which is a single engine air tanker coming out of Fort Collins.
Shifting winds have moved the fire. Officials say they will reopen three subdivisions to residents today.
And more finger-pointing after BP released its report on the causes of the Gulf oil spill. Transocean, they owned the rig that exploded. That company says BP made a series of cost-saving decisions in design and construction that increased the risk of failure. BP's outgoing CEO Tony Hayward will testify before the British Parliament next week as part of the investigation. Looking at the markets, Asian markets are mixed. European indices are up. Futures are way up on that positive employment news. The Dow's going to start at 10,387, the S&P at 1,098, the NASDAQ at 2228. So this morning, we really want to delve into this idea of what it means to be an American. What are our values? Is this weekend's Burn a Quran Day a Florida church issue of freedom of speech? Is that an American? Is that a Christian value? We're going to talk about that this later this hour. But we're going to explore the role that America has in the world. Are we in a historic moment that confirms our identity? Let us know.
Some new American moments and an old American moment. Politics. The president worries about politics. We'll talk about that in just a few minutes.
President Obama spoke to a hand-picked crowd of 800 people or so near Cleveland.
My most urgent task was to stop a financial meltdown and prevent this recession from becoming a second depression. In Ohio, we have done that. The economy is growing again. The financial markets have stabilized. The private sector has created jobs for the last 8 months in a row.
He also proposed $180 billion in new business tax breaks and infrastructure spending. That's all with the aim of getting businesses hiring again and, of course, the long-term goal of stimulating the economy. It was his second speech on the economy this week. We can expect more in the future. But
he's
to get
on message here.
He is. And, then,
and he's right about the creating jobs for the last 8 months in a row. It's a small number each month, but does this message stick? I think is really the key.
Well, and that's what we're going to ask our next two guests. Joining us from Kent, Ohio, to talk about Ohio's reaction to the president's speech and his proposals, we have M.L. Schulze, the news director for WKSU Public Radio. Good morning.
Good morning.
And in studio with us is Jim Nocte, a host of BBC Radio's Today Show. He's been covering American politics for 30 years, just back from Kentucky, I hear.
And other places, yes. Quite startling stuff.
Well, let me start with you, ML. Did you get a reaction from the people who attended the speech or from people in the region around Cleveland to what the president proposed?
Well, he was preaching to the converted, no question about that, while he was at Cuyahoga County Community College. He was saying the things that the base wants to hear. Number one, he's going to come out fighting. He's done the things that he needs to do that were midstream right now, and that any reversal of the political fortunes will have a very real impact on the attempt to get Ohio and other states to recover.
Well, Ohio, as we know, is part of a section of the country that was very hard hit by the recession, extremely high unemployment. The manufacturing industry took a dive. Is the economy doing better in Ohio, and is it going to help or hurt the president and his party come the midterms?
The economy is doing better, and it doesn't matter, because there still is an unemployment rate that tops 10%. Mm. In some ways, that's actually a good thing, because for years, our unemployment rate has outstripped the national rate by a significant amount. Now that gap is a lot closer. But you still have 85% of the people in the state know somebody personally who's been laid off. And even those who have jobs, which is 9 out of 10 people who are in the labor market, are still, they have this reservation in the back of their head, will I have a job tomorrow? And that stops them from buying cars, that stops them from buying new homes, that stops them from buying new television sets.
Well, or perhaps just, that the message and that reality is in the front of their head for sure. M.L. Schulze, news director at WKSU in Northeast Ohio, Kent State University, if I'm not mistaken, right, M.L.?
Absolutely.
So, Jim Nocte, what do you think is going on here? The immediate realities of the economy drowns out whatever message the president is trying to get out, which says we're making improvement.
Well, the immediate reality is something that is lost, and I think in two ways, John, because you're right that, you know, when you look at people who know someone who's unemployed, then the figures don't really mean very much in political terms. There's something else as well, I think, which is that for an outsider coming here in this political season, it's impossible to miss the depth of the anger. Some of it, of course, directed directly at the president, but a lot of it much more inchoate and based on all kinds of worries. And I think it leads people like me to conclude two things. One, that the whole Tea Party phenomenon, strange though it is, mixed up, factionalized, very hard to get a grip on in some parts of the country, is a genuine wildfire. There's something going on out there that is extraordinary. And the second thing is, and I think this was true in the 2008 campaign as an undercurrent, there are more and more people who have come to the conclusion that they can no longer be confident that the America that their children inherit is going to be a better off one than it was. And they had obviously all grown up with the idea that that was a given, that was a fact, that was the way the world worked. And I think what that means for people like me coming, knowing the country quite well and coming fairly regularly, is that there's an enormous sense of uncertainty about where this goes. And the people I've been talking to, in the streets, but also, if you like, intellectuals or social commentators on the right and the left, all argue that this kind of culture war, because as we know, the political arguments become a deeper culture war, is one whose course is really uncertain. It's all up for grabs. And I think for non-Americans coming in and looking at it, that's the really fascinating thing. I mean, clearly November is going to be very important and very interesting and probably quite dramatic. But it's what kind of America the next generation gets. Does it tilt in a socially conservative direction? And, if you like, does the Tea Party message take hold, or does it revert to something much more familiar? And I don't think there's an answer to that question. I don't think there's an answer here. There certainly isn't for outsiders looking
in. We may not even get an answer to that in November. ML, let me go back to you real quickly, because there have been comments made that the president is coming to this too late, that he had a message to give and now, a month before the midterms, is tardy. And I'm wondering, was there a moment in Ohio when the president could have taken advantage of? Was there a moment when the anger that you talk about, the frustration among residents of your state, were more receptive to the president?
Well, the one indication of that would be the polls. We have a governor, a Democratic governor, who's up for re-election. We have an open Senate seat that, until about a month ago, was still regarded as pretty much a toss-up, especially the gubernatorial race. And in the last month, we've really seen the figures start to separate. Governor Strickland is facing, right now, he's down in the polls. It's the kind of thing that come midsummer, I think the White House and I think a lot of political advisors were thinking, well, people don't tune in until after Labor Day. We can relax a little bit. We don't need to really press the political part of the message. And some of the folks around here are saying, no, with early voting now and with the tone of things, that the White House needed to get involved in the partisan political level a lot sooner.
Well, ML, do you think that, as Jim was saying, this is kind of a roulette wheel, that we really don't know the direction? We may see the poll numbers moving around. We may get a sense of this wildfire, but the direction is really unclear in Ohio.
Yeah, it is unclear. What is clear is that the Republican base is motivated. They're going to vote. What is not clear is that the Democratic base you have the teachers' unions who are a little ticked off at the president right now. You have some of the other unions who are a little uncertain of where things are going. So that base is a lot less certain. And then there's always the question, of course, of the swing voters, and Ohio is notorious for having them.
You're notorious for certain. ML Schulze, a news director for WKSU in Northeast Ohio, and Jim Nachty, hosted the BBC Radio's show Today. Thanks so much to both of you.
Fascinating.
In 15 minutes past the hour, let's check in on other stories.
A federal appeals court has ruled that former CIA prisoners can't sue over alleged torture overseas because such a lawsuit risks exposing government secrets. The American Civil Liberties Union plans to appeal the extraordinary rendition ruling to the Supreme Court. And we'll talk about that a little bit later on in the hour. In Pakistan, a missile strike killed 5 alleged militants early this morning, the 4th such attack in 24 hours. This morning, Pakistan's Ambassador Hussein Haqqani reacted to something else that's going on in the world. He said Americans should stand up against the planned 9/11 Quran burning scheduled for Saturday in Florida.
All these people who are against religious extremism and intolerance in the Muslim world should also speak out against meaningless gestures such as burning the Quran.
The president reacted on Good Morning America today. He called the planned Quran burning a recruitment bonanza for al-Qaeda. South Africa's police minister says the country's murder rate has dropped by nearly 9%. Credit goes in part to ramped-up security during the World Cup this summer.
In North Texas, 2 people have drowned in flooding from the remnants of Tropical Storm Hermine. Residents say they were unprepared for the tornadoes and floodwaters because the storm made a light landfall earlier this week. That's a look at some of the stories that we're watching this morning. And throughout the morning, we have a theme, and you're a part of it. What does it mean to be an American? What are our values and principles? In a few minutes, we're going to talk about what it means on both the historic and the global scale. And we want you to give us a call and tell us what moment in our history defines America. And on the international level, what does being an American mean there?
Hillary Clinton says this is the new American moment. In 1941, Henry Lewis said it was an American century the 20th century would be. Is that a downgrade from century to moment? You can weigh in at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
Hillary Clinton spoke yesterday at the Council of Foreign Relations.
The complexities and connections of today's world have yielded a new American moment, a moment when our global leadership is essential, even if we must often lead in new ways.
A new American moment.
What is she talking about?
Well, and that obviously makes you wonder, what kind of moment is it that she's talking about? Is it something like the finest hour
that
Churchill spoke of? Yeah, an hour. And you talked about the American century a moment ago. Or are we in something else? I mean, will we think of this time in the same context as we talked about the moon landing, that moment, or maybe the March for Civil Rights, which obviously took hours, the actual march? Clinton says America's leadership is essential, global leadership. And we're still asking what the role of America is. Are we still a world leader? And you've had a lot to say about this.
This is Roger from Farmville. America's role in the world should be limited. We see ourselves as the last superpower, the only superpower running the world, and yet that's not realistic any longer.
A listener in South Carolina texted us at 69866. Better question, who would be a leader if not us? And what if we take this to a different degree? A listener called Shred Festival writes on our site, I think America's role should be in comedy this time, like a romantic comedy. America's already done the action hero role, the drama role, and the science fiction role. We need to get to the comic relief role.
We may already be there, in some sense.
Tragically.
Indeed.
Yeah.
Well, the conversation continues on our site at thetakeaway.org. What is the role of America in the 21st century, or has our moment possibly passed? You know how to reach us. Hillary Clinton, in talking about this American moment, I think deliberately echoes what Henry Luce in Life magazine said back in 1941. Throughout the 17th century and the 18th century, Luce wrote, and the 19th century, this continent teemed with manifold projects and magnificent purposes. We were the most exciting flag of all the world and of all history. It was triumphal, and it was this purpose of freedom that characterized us. And in this spirit, all of us are called, each in his own measure of capacity, to create the first great American century, referring to the 20th century. Well, that sort of sense has been sort of returned to by journalists again and again, and actually was spoken about by someone who was on this program yesterday, Andrew Bacevich, author of Washington Rules, America's Path to Permanent War. Here's what he had to say about the American century a few months ago.
In a recent column in the Washington Post, the journalist Richard Cohen wrote that the American century is now over. Cohen's right, and the sooner we recognize that fact, the better.
The century's over. What we've got left, Hillary Clinton suggests, is an American moment.
Right. And then again, what kind of moment is it? How would we compare it with the other supposed defining moments of American history?
There
like
are
this
a lot
one?
Of historical moments in American history.
It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
The date's now indelible. It's going to be remembered as long as man survives. July 20th, 1969, the day man reached and walked on the moon.
American moment, a global moment, I think it's fair to say.
Absolutely. Our listeners actually have had a number of ideas about what were the defining moments in American history.
This is Dan Twyford from Nashville, Tennessee. The greatest moment in American history was definitely the Civil Rights Movement.
I have a dream that one day, down in Alabama, with its vicious racists, with its governor having his lips dripping with the words of interposition and nullification.
Those are moments that happened before my lifetime. Some of our listeners had ideas about defining moments that occurred in recent history.
This is Seth from Hoboken. My American moment was Obama's inauguration. I was watching with a great mix of Americans, foreigners, blacks, whites, and everything in between, and it was truly an American moment.
I stand here today humbled by the task before us, grateful for the trust you've bestowed, mindful of the sacrifices borne by our ancestors.
I think that's exactly what Hillary Clinton is reaching for, the idea that this moment now is a special one for America.
And if you buy that, then that calls for action on our part, as opposed to were this just a normal day. Right? I mean, if this is a real moment, then that means there's a change.
I think she's calling for what are we going to do with this moment?
Yeah, and there's a difference in this moment from the time before and the time after. Any time that we reach these moments in history, we kind of look to our leaders to give us the direction of where we're going to go. I'm reminded of what John F. Kennedy said, and he said, I look forward to a great future for America, a future in which our country will match military strength with moral restraint, wealth with wisdom, and power with purpose. And I think we're kind of there.
Well, these collective moments, I think, sort of define what America is all about. And we're asking you at 877-8-MY-TAKE, what are the moments that define America? What moments do we need never to forget to understand how to proceed forward? And what would be our global leadership at this moment? Hillary Clinton posed the question. You can answer it as well. What does the Secretary of State say?
a new American moment.
Define it for us at 8778-MYTAKE or post a comment at thetakeaway.org.
Do you have a defining moment?
I think America's more than a moment. Maybe that's the issue. Coming up, score one for the government. A Bush policy is defended by the Obama administration in court. Extraordinary rendition. A case in federal court. We'll talk about it in just a moment. Right now, let's check top news stories at 30 minutes after the hour. The president is speaking out about that Florida church's plans to burn copies of the Quran this weekend. In an interview this morning on ABC News, the president says the event has the potential to add fuel to an already inflamed fire.
This is a recruitment bonanza for Al-Qaeda. You could have serious violence in places like Pakistan or Afghanistan.
Among the voices condemning the plans for Saturday include General David Petraeus, who says the event is likely to trigger violent retaliation against American troops abroad.
The European Union says the number of children born out of wedlock has doubled over the past two decades and now accounts for more than a third of the region's births. The union finds 35% of births in 2008 occurred outside of marriage. That's up sharply from 17% in 1990. And scientists from Oxford University say large daily doses of vitamin B can cut the rate of brain shrinkage in half for elderly people with memory problems. The study was done to try and find out what effect the vitamin had on mild cognitive impairments. And checking in on the markets, it looks like they're all up, and that's probably on the positive employment news. The S&P is up about 9.5 points. The Dow is up significantly as well, about 81 points, and the NASDAQ is up about 15 points. Those are some of the news stories we're watching this morning.
Yeah, they're buying on Wall Street. Let's welcome Robert Chesney to the program, National Security Law Specialist at the University of Texas in Austin. Good morning, Professor.
Good morning. Thanks for having me on.
So we wanted to get a reaction from you from this news story that's big this morning. Federal Appeals Court has ruled that former CIA prisoners can't sue over alleged torture in overseas prison because their lawsuit risks exposing government secrets. This is sort of the latest episode in the controversy over the so-called extraordinary rendition program that we learned about during the Bush administration. First of all, what do you think the appeals court has really told us today?
Well, the appeals court, which was divided fairly closely, it was effectively 6-5 votes out there in the Ninth Circuit on the West Coast, effectively said that they agreed with the administration's position that lawsuits that implicate not just classified information, but information that public disclosure of which might harm national security, those kinds of lawsuits can't go forward. And this is a controversial position. Many people, including the 5 dissenting votes in this case, take the view that it, of course, is appropriate to protect individual items of evidence if they do involve secrets as they come up, but that the whole suit shouldn't be dismissed at the outset.
Now, is the issue here that government secrecy trumps issues like habeas corpus if you're out of the territory of the United States, as these prisoners claim they were in prisons around the world, which is what extraordinary rendition is all about?
You might think that it would be, but this case really doesn't have to do with the territorial aspects. You could imagine the exact same case being based on different facts where everything's within the United States. If the case is otherwise the same case involving alleged covert action programs, then the result would be the same. It did not turn on the territoriality question.
Now, you served in the Justice Department, so you have something of a window on where the Justice Department is headed, right?
Well, I can't comment on anything I might know about DOJ policy.
Gotcha.
Based on my service, but I can say that one of the interesting questions here is that when Obama was elected, a lot of people who supported him on this issue thought maybe he would chart a different course than past administrations of both parties. And they were surprised when, in the end, the Obama administration continued to argue that this case and others like it should be dismissed on state secrets privileged grounds. And I don't think people should have been surprised by that, because presidential administrations of both parties, going back at least to the Carter years, have been very, I wouldn't say aggressive necessarily, but very robust in their use of the privilege when cases involving covert action or covert activities come up.
All right, well, then let's explore that a little bit. I wanted to get a sense of your comfort level because you were associated with the Justice Department for a year. Robert Chesney is National Security Law Specialist at the University of Texas at Austin. Is the continuity here because of a concern about 9/11, or, as you say, does it go back farther than that to the Carter administration that basically White Houses and the executive is really interested in having these powers unchecked by Congress and other sorts of oversight?
Well, I wouldn't say that anyone's interested in having – well, there may be people who are interested in having them unchecked, but they're not actually unchecked. The question here is whether civil litigation, which clearly can be a pretty powerful check, whether that's going to be one of the tools to control and to keep within proper bounds executive branch activity that's carried on in secret, as a lot of CIA activity, for example, or NSA activity might be. And you then might ask, well, what is there if not civil lawsuits? Well, you mentioned congressional oversight. None of this impacts or relates directly to the question of whether the Senate and House Intelligence Committees can be aware of and take action in response to what might be going on. There are definitely questions there, but they're separate questions.
But the philosophical puzzle here, I think, for most Americans who are trying to sort out the legal details, and many of them, as you're explaining there, are arcane, is that it seems in principle that as far as executive power is concerned, if you simply raise the flag, government secrets, the moral issue of torture doesn't get to go before a judge or a jury in the United States of America.
Yeah, I like the way you put it there, because you've really kind of grabbed the core of the issue. What really turns on this is the question of whether you want there to be a way to have lawsuits and thus get judicial relief in cases in which people claim human rights or constitutional violations. You know, they've been spied upon, they've been tortured, whatever it is the claim may be. These are obviously terribly important questions. And the effect of the state secrets privilege, as it has been construed not just in recent years, but for a very long time, it's only recently we've realized this, or that the public more generally is beginning to realize this, is to keep litigation from being one route to control or to check that kind of behavior.
You know, the other thing that's disturbing, and I think of military families around the United States, and this is not to cast them in any sort of moral situation here, but it seems to me there's a double standard. If you're a CIA agent and you torture somebody, you say government secrets, you're off the hook. If you're a soldier on a battlefield and someone accuses you of torture, you're in court the next day, it seems to me, according to this this doctrine.
With all respect, I wouldn't interpret it that way. The question is, it's not agency or institutional specific, so it's not that the CIA always would get the benefit and the military never would. The question in any state secrets case is whether the suit is alleging secret activity. Now, anything having to do with interrogation is going to probably fall into that realm, whether it's a special forces operator, an army, you know, private, or a CIA agent, or and so forth. So to the extent you're comfortable or not comfortable with the privilege and its impact here, it would be the same for different types of entities.
All right. The president has said, I have said repeatedly, that America doesn't torture. I'm going to make sure that we don't torture. Those are part and parcel of an effort to regain America's moral stature in the world. Who's going to believe that based on this decision today?
Well, one of the first things President Obama did when he came into office was issue an executive order that pulled back in various important ways on prior policies relating to interrogation. He's, I think, been most clear on torture as compared to, say, detention in Guantanamo or some of these other issues like military commissions. Torture is where I think he's drawn the brightest lines and should get the most credit. I don't think that the fact that the administration does not want there to be civil lawsuits further exploring this undermines the claim or the position that they're actually opposed to torture.
Finally, Robert Chesney at the University of Texas at Austin, does this go to the Supremes?
I don't think it will, because usually the Supreme Court is most interested in taking cases when you have different courts of appeals around the country that disagree. And right now, after yesterday's decision, the courts of appeal are largely in agreement.
All right. Robert Chesney, National Security Law Specialist at the University of Texas at Austin, talking about the Ninth Circuit's ruling that former CIA prisoners can't sue in civil court over alleged torture overseas because their lawsuit risks exposing government secrets. Thanks, Professor.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you.
If you recognize that theme, it means that you watch football. When the leaves begin to turn, we all know what that means. It means that many people, most of them male in the nation, are going to sit down in front of the TV and watch the game. And, John, you're a football guy, right? You're a
fan? Actually, I tune in a little later in the season. It takes me a while to get geared up. But, yeah, I get a part of it.
All right. I want you to identify this voice from the past.
I get emotional over children and animals, not football games or baseball games or things that you do.
That takes me back. Johnny Unitas.
Baltimore Colts.
Baltimore Colts Hall of Famer. Quarterback.
I mean, arguably a truly American story. He was getting paid $6 a game as a semi-pro, became one of the most record-setting quarterbacks in the NFL. He won MVP several times in the 1950s
not
and 60s.
Not a guy who would hold out for a couple mil and not go to training
no,
camp. Right?
No.
Those were the old days.
Yeah. The NFL actually makes more money than any of its major league peers. Billions of dollars of revenue generated by everything from the T-shirts and the clothing to their TV deals and even these fantasy leagues that people play online. So we just had a lot of the fantasy league drafts, and here to tell us about the NFL money involved is the Wall Street Journal sports writer Nando DeFino. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good to see you. So why does football make more than the other sports?
I think it's a combination of things, but basically it boils down to the product. People want to see it. You know, it's you get 16 games with your favorite team every year, and that's it. It's gone. You know, it's got a very ephemeral quality to it, and it's just a lot of fun while it lasts.
Oh, but so the you're way saying the long baseball season hurts the sports.
It's 162 games against 16. I mean, you know.
But the way they slice those 16 games and spread them out and all the teams and produce the merchandising revenue. I mean, I read the NFL got $9 billion in new revenue last year in the middle of the worst recession since the 30s.
Yeah, they say in the recessions we cling to things like entertainment just to get away, and this is one of those things. You know, you're watching these kind of gladiators just go at it and hit each other and, you know, perform at the top levels that you're going to see anywhere.
Okay, I would imagine, Nando, though, that one of the stories you're going to be talking about a lot is the fact that we're now going into the season without the collective bargaining agreement. I mean, this could be a problem, right? I mean, how did this happen?
Well, it's basically there's a collective bargaining agreement between, you know, the owners and the players, and it just expired. So we're talking about a year this year where you can spend anything on any player you want, no matter what team you are, basically. And then next year, we're looking at a lockout because, I mean, the sides are so far apart that even, you know, the commissioner, yesterday the head of the NFLPA said, you know, it looks like there's going to be no season next year. Or just prepare yourself for no season next year.
No season next year.
It happened. Baseball lost the World Series. Hockey lost an entire season. The NBA lost a significant. It's every time this comes up and people say there might be a lockout, there might be a strike, it happens. And that's why people aren't too optimistic about it. I mean, I've talked to agents who have their players, you know, financially prepared to lose an entire season.
And will the fans come back?
Oh, the fans always come back, no question. I mean, it's. I think we're smart enough now to the point where we know it's. You know, there's no real good guy, bad guy here. The players want more money. The owners say they don't have enough to give the players more money. You know, it's.
Or we're dumb enough to come back year after year.
Well, you know, you want to see your football, yeah, though. Why hold a grudge?
Does the NFL have any assets that other sports don't have in defending against a lockout or the effects of a strike before we go?
I mean, nothing spectacular outside of just probably a better product than everybody, but. You know, they're going to have to come up with something to get the fans back. And they're very good at you know, relating with their fans and relating to their fans.
We'll find out how good they are.
Nando DeFino, sports writer for The Wall Street Journal. Thanks.
Anytime.
Good morning, everyone. John Huckenberry here with Celeste Headlee. Let's check leading stories at 47 minutes after the hour. This week, unemployment numbers came out, and initial jobless claims fell by 27,000. They were expecting 2,000. That was from the previous week's revised figure. It's a two-month low. Economists said it was going to be much smaller than that, and futures are on fire this morning. The Dow Jones Industrial Average is up significantly. Situation in Mexico going from bad to worse, according to Secretary of State Hillary Clinton. She says the drug war south of the border is a major concern.
We face an increasing threat from a well-organized network drug trafficking threat that is in some cases morphing into or making common cause with what we would consider an insurgency.
Her comments follow reports of a murder of yet another Mexican mayor by suspected drug cartel hitmen.
The European Union says Iran's decision to suspend the stoning sentence against a woman convicted of adultery is not enough. This morning, the EU called for the sentence to be completely overturned. New documents released by the Army say a staff sergeant charged with murdering Afghan civilians kept body parts from his victims and threatened his subordinates. Documents charging Staff Sergeant Calvin Gibbs and four other soldiers say Gibbs kept finger bones, leg bones, and a tooth that was taken from Afghan corpses. And British scientists have made a big breakthrough on a question that's haunted men everywhere. What dance moves do women find the most attractive?
Oh, get out of here.
Researchers filmed 18 to 35-year-old men dancing in a lab and then turned them into faceless computerized figures so women could rate their moves. Cautious dance moves got very poor ratings, while women rated bold, expressive flailing as highly attractive.
Yeah, but you can't count any of those statistics because the women's feet weren't being stepped on by the men.
You know what? We get used to that. Those are some of the news stories that we're watching this morning.
So back to the story of the announced Quran burning, which will take place on September 11th if plans go ahead down in Gainesville, Florida. Divergent views of what it means to be an American, I think, is at the heart of this controversy. Here's Pastor Terry Jones in Gainesville, Florida, with his own ideas of what it means to be in America and why he plans to proceed with this particular protest on September 11th, this coming Saturday.
We just have also the concern as to how far do we go as Americans? When do we back down? Or when does the time come that we speak to radical Islam and we tell them no more? We will not be pushed around and we will not bow to threats.
Terry Jones's particularly American message, we will not be pushed around, we will not bow to threats, speaking to radical Islam around the world. But is that the message that's going to be received? And who else is receiving that message? Joining us now is Dan Johnson, who's a minister at Trinity United Methodist Church in Gainesville, Florida. Dan, good morning.
Good morning.
Also, a pastor of Christ Church in Moscow, Idaho, Douglas Wilson, joins us. Douglas Wilson, good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having us.
So both of you pastors, at least in one case, Dan Johnson, in the same community as Terry Jones, how are you mobilized by the message that Terry Jones wants to get out of an America not backing down, of a condemnation of radical Islam that he says is perfectly within his rights and a message that America needs to hear right now? Dan Johnson, you begin.
We're mobilized in two ways. One, we're speaking out against it because we think it's wrong. It may be it's right, but it's a wrong decision. And then secondly, as a Christian, fellow Christian and minister of the gospel, we're mobilized by our scriptures as we understand them to foster a gathering for peace, understanding, and hope, one which is co-sponsored with the Gainesville Interfaith Forum that causes us to live in appreciation and respect for persons of other faiths. And we are getting great responses and think there's going to be several thousand at this event tomorrow night. So that's our take on this.
Douglas Wilson, you know, in some sense, part of the lesson here is you announce a Quran burning in the United States and suddenly you've got CNN cameras in your backyard. The world media story suddenly makes this a giant global issue. What has most frustrated you about media coverage of this story, and what would you do differently, Douglas Wilson?
Well, I would say that the most striking and funny thing about this is a small church in Florida, a handful of people, and the President of the United States has denounced them, the Attorney General has called them idiots, the Vatican has denounced them, there have been protests in Kabul, and I would say that if the lesson we wanted him to learn is that this sort of thing doesn't work, then we have all conspired to not teach him that lesson. Their takeaway from this is, man, that was a roaring success. Everybody has flocked around this issue and they've made it into the issue that it ought not to have been. Now, I would say that the central thing that I would want to say here is, first, as a Christian minister, I would tell him that in Acts 19, it is true that a bunch of converts to the Christian faith burned their books of sorcery and that sort of thing, but they were their own books that they burned. It was an act of repentance that they were coming out of sorcery and witchcraft. They burned their own books, not the books of others. And then in that same chapter, when there was a riot in Ephesus, there were some pagans who defended the Apostle Paul by saying that Paul and these men are not blasphemers of our goddess. In other words, Paul was opposing paganism, but there were certain things that he did not do in that opposition. So I would urge Pastor Jones to oppose Islam, as I do. I believe that Islam is a false teaching, and all of everything he says about not backing down, I agree with. But this is not a smart, shrewd way to do it. And it just highlights the double standard that everybody has, because in the Ground Zero mosque, everybody's saying, well, we need to defend their right to do this. But here, we're calling them idiots and scoundrels. So I think we need to play this with an even hand.
Dan Johnson, minister at Trinity United Methodist Church. Let me ask you, if there's one thing that has that good to come out of the Quran burning, and hope that hopefully there's nothing tragic that comes as a result globally, but I'm wondering if you feel it has brought a discussion to the forefront that perhaps the United States needed to have.
Well, I think, I don't know about the nationally, but locally, the good has come that the persons of different faiths have come together to discuss and to share. I think the other thing that's emerging is, I think this country is more eager now than ever to hear moderate voices, and they're tired of hearing the people on the fringe and being taken hostage by people on the fringes so much. And as the person in Idaho says, it's... you know, the news has just fanned the flames. I mean, like you said, there's like 30 people in this little church.
But let me go back to Douglas Wilson, because you make the point, Dan Johnson, that, yeah, it's a small group. They've been called idiots. But Douglas Wilson, you said a moment ago that you believe that Islam is a false teaching, right?
Yes, I'm a Christian.
Right, no, I understand. How do you reconcile that belief, and I totally understand that belief, with a message of tolerance? Because it sounded like what you were saying a moment ago is that he's not taking a terribly shrewd tactic in opposing Islam, but that comes short of actually being tolerant of the sensitivities of Muslims about their Quran being burned.
Certainly. One of the things that we have to come to grips with is that Terry Jones is in trouble for burning the Quran. But there are a bunch of other people who were in trouble with radical Islam for things that were should be perfectly acceptable to do. I think of the Danish cartoonist fiasco.
Sure.
So you can't judge whether or not it's appropriate to do by the reaction of Muslims worldwide. Sometimes they declare fatwas off of, you know, bizarre sorts of things, and other times they respond to deliberate attempts at provocation, which is what I would say this is. This is a deliberate attempt to provoke, and it worked. And other times, it's not the same category, and yet you get the same reaction. And it just highlights the double standard of secularist America. We don't know how to process this sort of thing. We don't know how to handle the outliers and the radical voices.
Well, if this goes ahead on Saturday, we will get a chance to see how it reverberates in the United States, in the secular community, in communities of faith in the U.S. and around the world. Douglas Wilson, pastor of Christ Church of Moscow, Idaho, speaking there, reacting to the announced Quran burning that will take place in Gainesville, Florida, if all goes according to plan, on Saturday. Also, thanks to Dan Johnson, a minister at Trinity United Methodist Church, a certain kind of ground zero. He'll be right there in Gainesville this weekend. Keep the conversation going. What do you think?
This is Greg from Baltimore, and I really think the religious controversies and conflicts we're experiencing are a reflection of the world growing into a global society. We are becoming one world, and these are the growing pains of that experience.
You can call, too. What growing pains do you think we're experiencing, or is it regression, not growth at all? 877-8-MY-TAKE. Tell us what you think. I'm John Hockenberry.
And I'm Celeste Headley. This is The Takeaway.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, the New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.